This is The Conversation, a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. Happy Pesach. Happy Easter. Happy 420. It is 420 today. It's episode 241 with Natasha Dagan. She is the chair of the Art Market Studies program at FIT, that's Fashion Institute of Technology, which is part of the State University of New York. And yes, we talk about the market, and not in a speculative way, rather more in a generally more a scholarly way, because she is a scholar, an academic about the market, not just some kind of speculator. And the way that we connected is she wrote an op-ed in the LA Times back in February titled, "In this age of glossy art fairs and mega galleries, can public museums survive?" The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see an image of Natasha and her with some of her students out of the galleries. And before we get into other things, I wanted to give you, particularly LA listeners, Los Angeles-based listeners, a quick event announcement. A week from now, on April 27th at 1 p.m. in Culver City at the Edward Chella Gallery, right on La Cienega, Chris Truman, the artist who has the show up at Edward Chella right now, and I will be doing a little talk, I don't know, walkthrough, more of a talk about his work and whatnot. So there will be wine and whatnot afterwards, after the talk. So those of you in LA, particularly who are going to be in Culver City-ish anyway, please come by 1 p.m. All right, look forward to seeing you there. And this will not be an episode, so best to hear it in person and see it. Huge thank you to those of you listeners who stepped up after my call to action for financial support in conjunction with the Max Haven Art After Money series, part one last time. Thank you so much. And as much as I would love to say that is the end of fundraising for a while, actually, it's just the beginning. Hooray! I realized that in lieu of advertising per episode, I think it's somewhat realistic that if I remind you and if I ask nicely, that we can raise in the neighborhood of $200 per episode in lieu of getting an ad. I would ask for around that, maybe a little bit more, for an ad on the show in the intro. So I am going to be asking those of you who have not donated yet, and if you haven't, I have a question for you. What kind of language would be most helpful to you to get you to donate? For those of you who already have, especially recently, thank you again. If you haven't in a while, maybe this is a time to come back into the fold. There are a couple of people at the $10 a month level on Patreon, and if we can just get another 18, we will be good to go. In lieu of that, you know, you can certainly donate via PayPal through the website, or Venmo, or old-fashioned check, or you can pitch in a smaller amount on Patreon. All those things would be much appreciated. Just go to the website, theconversationpod.com/support. And there's a bonus episode with Natasha Dagan, which I will tell you about more on the back end, and that will go to donators to the show. So more on that on the back end. Yeah, why don't we get into this episode? Among the things that we talk about are the students that she is putting out into the art worlds, either galleries, auction houses, advisors, etc., and to what extent their program grooms them or does not, because we talk about finishing schools for the art world and whatnot. And we also talk about the panel that she was involved in about art and money laundering. And we finish up with a great anecdote about a Chinese artist in New York from mainland China who passed on an opportunity to have a show at a Lower East Side gallery, but meanwhile had sold out everything in her studio to a Chinese collector slash investor. So that's all coming up to look forward to. And on the back end, we do have Weiss Links. I will tell you more about the bonus episode with Natasha and what we talk about. And just to give you a little preview of the old news, as in Weiss Links, for the week, we're going to talk about Mary Boone's farewell tour. which is to say she's going to prison. And I thought it would be good to read from the Town and Country piece about her, because I did mention in brief in a past Old News about her and her situation with tax fraud. So all that to look forward to. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you again to all of you who recently supported the show, and I hope to see many more of you soon. Talk to you on the back end.
So I'm the chair of the Art Market Studies Department at FIT, the Fashion Institute of Technology, which is part of the State University of New York. So essentially, I run a master's program. It's a master's of arts program that prepares people to work in the art world. So galleries, auction houses, appraisal firms, nonprofits, art museums, things like that.
And FIT has been, for the longest time, correct me if I'm at all wrong, you know, a place for people getting into the fashion industry. So when did they implement or, you know, add out their program to be art world oriented?
Yeah, so a lot of people don't realize that FIT actually is comprised of some different schools. So they have a business school on the undergraduate level. They also have a fine arts school and a liberal arts school. So of course they're known for fashion, but actually there may even be more arts oriented programs and departments than there are fashion programs. So I think of, you know, FIT as, of course, a place that has a very established reputation in the fashion industry, but, you know, our program actually dates back to 1987 when it started as a gallery management program.
Okay.
So it was really the earliest, at least as far as I know, the earliest program of its kind in the U.S. possibly, that was focusing on the art world, and of course started in the late 80s during the boom years of the 1980s art market.
Mm-hmm. So if you take me as an example, not that that's the best example, maybe FIT has a little bit of a promotional challenge when it comes to making itself more known as a, you know, an art training destination in addition to being a fashion training destination.
I mean, it's definitely a challenge for our program. I think that there's always an issue of branding and also visibility, because it's not FIT, you know, maybe is associated with fashion or design and less so with the visual arts. And so I always find, you know, part of my job is just spreading the word and letting people know that this program exists, and that, you know, we don't have, even though, you know, students are able, if they're interested in learning more about fashion or other creative industries, you know, we're explicitly focused in the art world. And so, I think you're right that there may be a branding issue there, but, you know, it's also, I think, interesting to be part of a much larger institution that, you know, comprises not just the visual arts, but also other creative fields. And I think that does somehow contribute to our understanding of this sort of niche industry.
Would I be correct in assuming that you get to be an academic in terms of doing research and writing and, you know, as opposed to doing a lot of administrative type stuff that a chair often does, or do you do both?
I really do both. And, you know, there's some complications with that, wearing many hats. And I think it's also a challenge given the nature of the program. So art market studies means that, you know, there's a pre-professional aspect to the program. We're really preparing people to forge careers in the art world. And so, you know, many of our instructors are people who have full-time jobs elsewhere and are bringing a wealth of professional experience and really focusing on the practical skills required to enter this field. But at the same time, I mean, I think it's really important to be academically rigorous, to give students an awareness and a strong background in the history and theory and critical context. So we're not just cheerleaders for the art market, but also giving them a very well-rounded view of the whole landscape. But what that means is that, you know, I feel like my job is administrative. I do oversee the curriculum. I oversee the admissions process. I oversee sort of faculty and students. But I also am actively researching and writing, you know, when I can, participating in academic conferences and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Is it as overwhelming as it sounds? I mean, if you're doing all those things that you just described and you're just, you know, you just finished a book proposal, I mean, how many hours in a day?
It definitely keeps me busy, especially this time of year where we're in the thick of our, you know, admissions process and planning for the next academic year. But I think it's good in that, you know, it's definitely using different parts of my brain constantly. So academic research can be very solitary and lonely. But then I also get to interact with our students who are, you know, constantly sort of inspiring. And I find that actually to be possibly the most gratifying part of my job is teaching and working with students and mentoring students. But, you know, also a lot of liaising with a professional world, with an industry, with the art world. And so, you know, trying to get guest speakers to come in, going to art world events, it definitely requires, you know, a lot of multitasking, sort of, you know, not only following, say, academic conferences, but also art world events. Both of those can be full-time endeavors on their own. But, you know, I think it's also really exciting and dynamic to have a foot, you know, both in the academic world and in a more professional world and sort of straddle two very different fields.
But if I could challenge you just a little bit on that.
Yeah.
If you are the chair of this department at FIT, and you certainly are interacting with the professional world, as you called it, you know, which is to say people, professionals working in the art world, quote unquote, however professional they may be, it depends very much on the situation, I would imagine. But but you do have, correct me if I'm wrong, you do have the safety of academia or the university institution, as opposed to being, as you were before, and maybe this is a good segue to some extent to that,
a
freelance writer, you know, where you have almost the opposite level of security.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a reason why a lot of artists and, you know, creative, you know, again, not to overuse the word professional, but creative professionals, whether those be visual artists or, you know, writers or, you know, playwrights or people from a variety of different creative fields, why they turn to teaching. And I mean, you know, financial security and stability is, of course, a big part of that. So, you know, that's not something that I reject by any means. Although, you know, I think in my case, I've always had an interest in both sides. And so even when I was a freelance writer, you know, I had deferred grad school for some of that period, and then I continued with freelance writing and criticism when I was in grad school. And so, you know, I think I had always sort of had this slightly uncomfortable, slightly, I don't know, kind of contradictory identity with, you know, one foot in each world. And I think they actually, in a lot of ways, are very complementary, especially for someone like me who has looked at the art market from an academic perspective and from the perspective of a journalist. You know, I do think that if you look at who really knows the most about what's happening at this moment and who really has the most comprehensive view of what's happening, I think you have to turn to journalists, people who are regularly speaking, not just to the people, you know, in their office, in their gallery, at their auction house, but who are speaking to people across the field, who are speaking to artists, who are speaking to collectors, who are speaking to people involved in sales as well as institutions. And so for me, it was complementary, although, I mean, to your earlier point, it can also be sort of overwhelming to juggle all of these different things, maybe feel like, you know, none of them you're doing fully. All of them you're kind of doing with some fraction of your time.
Right. Another framing point that I think is important, and I was thinking about this after we had our initial conversation, and you just you mentioned it briefly in passing earlier, which is that you're not a cheerleader for the art market. And when we spoke earlier, you said, you know, you're not a cheerleader for the art market, nor are you a Marxist, sort of on the other end of the spectrum. And I wondered, though, just since you mentioned it in passing again now, when you are teaching the art market to students, some of whom, I don't know to what, you know, what percentage, but some of whom, say, are going to work at auction house, you know, Sotheby's maybe, some maybe are going to work at galleries, et cetera. So would it be fair to maybe guess that they're getting a fairly in-depth understanding of the art market and how it works through the classes in your program, and then they have that knowledge, but once they get into whether it's an auction house or a gallery, let's say, to use two examples, they then have to a certain extent, become cheerleaders?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that definitely what our program provides is a lot of practical knowledge of the way these business models operate, whether that be, you know, an art gallery, a commercial gallery, or an auction house. But I also think it's important that we provide, you know, historical perspective so students realize that, you know, it's not that things have always operated the way they're currently operating. And in fact, I would argue that we're really in a moment of transition and things are in flux. And so students also have to be equipped for that and anticipate that there may be changes ahead. And so, you know, I think having that perspective hopefully gives them, you know, some distance in a way. I think once people enter a professional role, you know, you kind of get subsumed by that organization, and I think it does affect your way of thinking, but I would hope anyway that our students also are equipped to have a little bit of distance and see wherever they find themselves as part of a larger sort of, you know, ecosystem in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, that, like, for instance, I think sometimes if you're working in sales, you might start to see artworks as sort of divorced from any kind of context, you know, from the artist who created it and the dealer who initially promoted it and, you know, the fabricator who made it and all of these people who have been actively contributing to not only just the production of the artwork, but the way in which it's accrued value and the way in which it's understood. And so, you know, I think that's really important, that students see art in a broad context, but also have, you know, a bit of perspective on what they're participating in.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of perspective, what you mentioned, this transition that we are either beginning or are in, maybe in a specific way as possible, could you put your finger on what that is?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that are shifting at the moment. You know, I think that originally we got connected because of a piece that I wrote for the LA Times, an op-ed piece, and
Right. That
piece is in part about the ways in which galleries at the highest level, the so-called, you know, mega galleries maybe, are becoming brands and are becoming much more public-facing. So, you know, it used to be that galleries really were targeting a very small number of people and relied on a really small kind of group of clients for the vast majority of their sales. And that still is true. I saw in a recent article that Mark Glimcher of Pace Gallery, for instance, talked about having less than 1,000 clients, but having 800,000 Instagram followers. And so I think galleries now are really thinking, one, how do we engage these, you know,
799,000?
Yeah, 799,000 unknowns or maybe unknowns, and, you know, maybe even how to monetize that. And, you know, I think that there's a few things that are going on. One is, you know, the rise of digital technology, the rise of social media. Also, I think this new public interest in contemporary art, as the market has really shifted to post-war contemporary art, and also as the public has become much, much more interested and cognizant of contemporary art, I think that you do have this demand and this interest that a lot of art market players were not really capitalizing on. They were really just thinking of that, you know, 0.001%. And so how do you engage this broader public? And also, what role does that play, that attention and that interest, in creating more consensus and more value ultimately for individual works of art, and for sort of how does that contribute to the canonization of the artists in your roster?
You mentioned about the greater public interest, or the public being more interested in post-war contemporary art. What are the metrics that back that up. I mean, certainly you can talk about places like the Broad, you know, and the whole selfie thing. You can also talk about the experience museums, you know, that they're called many things, the pop-up museums. But in terms of the market, I mean, to take that one example that you used of the 800,000 followers for this Pace guy, I mean, is that, you know, you just have multiple examples like that, and that's what gives you that kind of backing for that statement?
Well, I think attendance figures at museums and particular exhibitions, we've seen rising attendance figures. We've also seen, you know, the kind of global expansion of the sort of contemporary art infrastructure, so not just major museums in the West, but also new markets like China, you know, new museums in the Middle East, new museums in other sort of non-Western countries that also have seen a huge surge of, you know, interest and attendance. You know, I think you see art fairs becoming mainstream brands. For instance, I have friends who don't even have anything to do with the art world, who aren't necessarily going to gallery shows regularly or maybe occasionally go to museums, and yet they want to go to Art Basel, and it has this sort of cachet.
Why do your friends want to go to Art Basel who aren't generally interested in contemporary art?
You know, I think this is something that I mentioned in the LA Times piece too. I think it's become a brand kind of like Coachella or Burning Man. It has this sort of cachet. It seems like a place that you want to be seen, that where, you know, there may be celebrities that are present, and certainly Art Basel in recent years has seen performances this last year, you know, Cardi B or Kanye showing up at a Prada party. So it's not just about the fair itself. And in fact, I think many people who want to go to Art Basel may not even set foot in the fair, but they want to be part of this circuit of parties and events and concerts and promotional activities. A lot of fashion brands are present for the week of this fair. And, you know, of course, there's now so many fairs that take place in Miami during that week, but there's also, you know, I think Miami during that time becomes a sort of meeting place, a site of convergence for all of these different sort of creative industries that are capitalizing on the draw of the brand Art Basel.
So maybe some of these friends of yours are fashion aficionados, for example?
Yeah, but also people like lawyers. You know, some people, I think, yes, they're in the fashion world, and, you know, they know that there's going to be these different parties and brand launches or product launches. And I think Freeze in L.A. saw that to some extent, too. Mm-hmm. You know, different brands sort of setting up pop-ups or you know, launching particular lines or products to coincide with the art fair. But yeah, I think that, you know, the art world has become so event-driven between this sort of relentless calendar of art fairs and biennials, but also calendar of parties and openings where it becomes a sort of, you know, social circuit. And that has a lot of appeal.
You know, I have to say, at the risk of being a little pejorative, is this like the high cultural equivalent of the Bridge and Tunnel crowd? All these people converging on these types of events?
Maybe. and I think there certainly is a hierarchy. You know, there's the VIPs, the same way that for art fairs, uh-huh. It's sort of a litmus test for how
where you are in the art world,
right? Whether you get to go in at 11 a.m., right. Noon, 1 p.m.
Right.
So it's the same thing. I think there's a hierarchy of parties and dinners and other kinds of events, too.
You told me that when you worked at Sotheby's Institute, you once interviewed a prospective student who was working for a Thomas Kincaid gallery at his local mall. That in itself is worthy of some analysis. But,
right.
But you went on to say, he mentioned his student loans, and you asked the question, what are the ethics of admission in an instance like this one? So that's really a paradigm shift, somebody who's working at Thomas Kincaid Gallery and going to Sotheby's. I mean, was this somebody who was was catching on fire with all of the information that he was taking in, or was he somebody who was savvy despite his job?
Well, I don't want to go into too, like, I don't want to identify who this person is, but I will say that, you know, when we would interview people, this is often a kind of conundrum, because so much of what translates into professional success in the art world is a sort of, you know, cognizance of a certain vocabulary and social etiquette. And there is a class dimension to that. So, you know, when I interviewed a student, for instance, who was working at Thomas Kincaid Gallery, and coming from a place that was very far from an art world center, I think that there was maybe a lack of understanding about what it would take to, you know, say, make a career in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I think these programs, my program at FIT and certainly our peer programs, Sotheby's or Christie's or the NYU program, I mean, that's part of what they're there for, right, is to give a point of access to people. Maybe they see the art world as sort of impenetrable or inaccessible, and we're there to kind of make it more accessible, to bring in guest speakers and to have instructors who can speak to the realities of this business. And in some cases, it's about disillusioning or disabusing students of some notions. Like they see, oh, there's a $450 million Leonardo sold, and so I'm going to work for Christie's and I'll be getting a cut of that sale. And, you know, part of our job is to disabuse them of certain preconceived notions. And mm-hmm. I think part of our job is to also give them the tools that they'll need in order to successfully transition from a student who maybe studied art history or fine arts or economics or whatever and now wants to be in the art world. But it's complicated, because you do see that some students come to these programs already with a wealth of contacts. You know, they might be the child of a prominent collector. They might be, you know, one of my former students, the son of a prominent artist. They could be somebody, though, who's just grown up in this milieu. And as a result of that, you know, do they even really need to be taking the program for entree? No. I mean, I think we're still contributing important sort of academic, you know, to have academic, a kind of academic understanding and a more comprehensive understanding of the art world, I think is still very valuable. But there is an interesting class dimension. And so, you know, should you be admitting the person who has a lot of student loans and, you know, clearly is not familiar with the way the art world operates and maybe studied art and art history, and has a desire to be in this professional world without having an awareness of all of the sort of dynamics at play? I think it's a really big question. And I think for a program like ours, we're part of a state university system. So I see one of our potential sort of roles as being an agent of diversity in this field. And yet, you know, it's a complicated thing, because it is a field that has historically been so socioeconomically and racially homogenous.
Mm-hmm. Did this student who was working at Thomas Kincaid, did this prospective student at Thomas Kincaid become a student or no?
You know, he did not enroll, so I don't really know exactly what the outcome was. This was at a time when I was doing interviews for admission, but I wasn't really, like, now I oversee the admissions process, so I know whether or not students mm-hmm. get an offer
right.
and whether or not they take it. So I don't really know, but I don't know. I don't want to speculate too much about what happened to him.
What is the tuition per year or per the whole program?
Well, because we're part of the State University of New York, we have in-state and then out-of-state tuition. In-state tuition, we're a three-semester program. I think it's, you know, I don't have the exact numbers off the top of my head. It's under $20,000 for in-state students, the whole program.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like $18,000 and change.
Mm-hmm.
And then out-of-state is double that.
Okay, got it.
Which, well, I mean, even in itself, it's not, you know, unfortunately, we're not in a position where where everybody attends for free, or, right. you know, like many PhD students where you attend a program and you get a stipend. I would love to be in that position. But still, I mean, we're really a fraction of the price of many of our peer programs.
You mentioned when we were talking, I think, initially about this one prospective student and just generally about the sort of grooming for the art world. And you what kind of pricked up my ears is you mentioned the sort of awareness of a certain level of sophistication was sort of the implication, you know, around contemporary
right.
art. But you also mentioned in that same sentence the etiquette. And I wondered, let's just say you took a random MFA graduate, right, who is clearly to a certain degree, if not more, sophisticated about contemporary art and maybe even to some extent as well about the ways of the art world. Say somebody
right.
who's been out a few years. But what I was wondering is how much of that additional layer of social etiquette, you know what I mean, is something that is either, you know, you grow up with or is a gift. But, you know, if you're a little rough around the edges, maybe it's a little too much to overcompensate to become a professional in that way.
Well, there's definitely a lot of sociological work to be done in this regard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you see with MFA students, it's, you know, part of what they're learning is not just art making, but how to talk about work, how to talk about art in a way that will signal to curators or to dealers or to people in the art world that they belong to a certain segment of artists, those who will be taken seriously by, say, institutions and the art market, essentially, you know, the sort of establishment art world. And I think all academic programs, I mean, this is the process of professionalization for better or worse. It's also self-protective. It's sort of policing the boundaries of this world, of this network of people. And so, yes, I think that programs like ours, we want our students to be successful. We want them to, you know, have professional opportunities and to be able to choose what job they take. And part of that is understanding, you know, the sort of language that people in the art world use, the way to talk about works of art. I do think, though, at the same time, there, again, can be a kind of coded language, and I think I mentioned this to you before, like I'll get a lot of ads or job announcements from prospective employers, and sometimes there will be a kind of coded language in that. You know, they're looking for somebody who's elegantly presented.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned like rough around the edges. You know, I think that this is the kind of thing that, you know, is a way for the art world to sort of be self-protective and to kind of be exclusive in a certain way. And at the same time, you know, especially when you're talking about commercial businesses, they have every incentive to not buck the trend and to do the thing that's going to be most profitable and advantageous to them. But I also think that, you know, I hope that one of the things a program like mine can do is to give students of a real variety of backgrounds the ability to be part of this conversation and to contribute, you know, maybe alternative narratives, maybe a different way of doing things, maybe a more inclusive vision. And, you know, I think that's something the art world needs, but there's also a lot of things that the art world does to kind of keep the status quo.
Right.
The status quo.
I'm just wondering if, for example, you have somebody who is in your program who wants to be in a commercial gallery situation. And
right.
maybe, so if you take two examples, two fictional examples, let's say one is, you know, has the etiquette down, and but maybe doesn't really have, you know, maybe is physically not as attractive as most galleries would need as an entry level for that. And maybe the other person is physically attractive in that way, but maybe they're a little bit naive or what have you, you know, in certain ways. It seems like the latter would be a more realistic candidate because those various subtleties of etiquette could be taught, whereas the physical things cannot be changed without surgery?
I mean, that's a really difficult question, and I think there are some commercial galleries that probably do care a lot about physical appearance and sort of superficial things. I mean, I would hope that, again, part of what we do in our program is try and equip our students with, you know, a wealth of knowledge that will impress potential employers where they can see that they have a lot to contribute. But, you know, there's also a lot of jobs in the art world that are effectively, you know, being that gatekeeper at the front desk. And, you know, what employers choose to value is, you know, obviously up to them. But I do think that there are positive signs that things are changing a little bit. I think that you do see, you know, the same way that gallerists, I think, are looking at their artist rosters and realizing, oh, wait, we only have, you know, white men of a certain age, or, you know, we've only represented this particular kind of artist. And, you know, if we're going to expand our artist roster, maybe we should think about diversifying. I think the same maybe is happening in arts institutions too. And certainly museums have led the way with this. But I do think it's trickling down. And maybe it will get to the point where only employing the sort of most stereotypical employees will actually be a liability rather than an advantage.
Yeah, I was also more specifically wondering about, for example, this former guest on the show who went to work early on out of school at one of the big brand name galleries, described her experience, I think it was 6 months, you know, maybe not much more than that, as finishing school. And I'm just wondering if, you know, you mentioned how you're training or educating your students, you know, in this, that, and the other. I'm wondering how specific your knowledge you get in terms of actually teaching some of those very finishing school like elements, or if that's something more, you know, that would feel like going a little too far if you actually taught that.
Yeah, I mean, I think for better or worse, we're not doing that. You know, not to say that you know, posture or self-presentation isn't important. I think we do that on the level of, for instance, public speaking, on the level of like self-presentation through a resume or through written materials, through one's writing, professional communication. I think those are things we definitely address.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, we're not a finishing school, right? So it's an academic program, and
right,
we're much more focused on like skills and knowledge areas rather than the self-presentation part, even though, I mean, yes, there's a good argument that maybe that is in some ways equally valuable or equally valuable to some. But I would also say that is maybe changing. And I think, you know, some institutions, like within the art world, I think people know of certain galleries or auction houses as being more concerned with the superficial. And ultimately, I think that will be perhaps to their detriment, affiliated with like a very sort of specific kind of culture.
What about Sotheby's, where you used to teach yourself? Do you think they're doing finishing school type teaching there?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't work there anymore, and I would say when I did work there, I felt very good about my colleagues and what we imparted to students. You know, I think programs like this, sometimes there can be, like, I have encountered people who have a pejorative view and see them as a kind of finishing school type thing, and that's why, you know, since I've been at FIT and we've, you know, revamped the curriculum, we've tried to be really explicit about this is grounded in an academic discipline. And, you know, within art history, I think there's much more interest now and a growing interest in the history of the art market and in the way that economic trends and social conditions affect the reception of art, are affecting, you know, what art is considered important. And I think that is ultimately the sort of context for what we do. It is very pre-professional in some ways, but it can't just be, you know, handwriting and posture and what to wear to an interview. And so I think that we give students a lot of exposure to the full range of possibilities in the art world. But also you have to realize, I think, that, you know, if you look at the jobs that are coming up in the art world, you see a lot of galleries. I mean, certainly the mega galleries are expanding, but a lot of other galleries maybe have been closing up shop. And so we're seeing more and more opportunity in maybe some roles that are a little bit less public facing, but are actually growing, like things like art insurance and art shipping and logistics and online platforms, online sales, appraisal firms, art advisors. So, you know, those are not necessarily, maybe those are not the kind of gallerina type jobs mm-hmm. that would have been the go-to entry-level position in the past.
Mm-hmm. Right. One thing I was wondering about is, since the market is and has been your area of focus, and this is going to be a little abrupt and maybe sensational, but one thing that I like to think about in terms of the art market and the art world is rich people. And I wonder, you know, having been covering the art world and the market from a journalist's perspective and now being more in academia, you know, if that perspective for you has changed. I mean, to what extent are you, I don't know what the right word is, protected, you know, where it's not as much of an issue, you know, in the academia that you're in versus when you were sort of more out and about, you know, a duck, you know, in a row out, you know, as a journalist. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I know this is a little vague, but...
You mean in terms of, like, interfacing with, like...
Yeah, I mean, you did mention a couple of anecdotes that...
Yeah.
Yeah, so you can... That's not a very pointed question, but I wanted to throw that out there.
I mean, I think my interaction with, you know, dealers and collectors was very different, or is very different when I'm working as a journalist than in my role as, you know, an academic.
Mm-hmm.
I've interviewed dealers and been in their office as, you know, collectors have come through or seen them interact with their employees, and you kind of get a sort of, you're obviously an outsider, but you can get the sense of what it's like on the inside, maybe through having conversations and just observing somebody doing business in, you know, while the conversation is unfolding. It's led to some kind of funny moments, I mean, including seeing gallerists, like, berating their employees, thinking that, well, you're writing about something else, so, you know, I don't really care about what you're seeing. And I think that maybe belies a certain, you know, I think some people, if they're always used to people working for them, and they don't really care about the optics of that, or there's this sort of arrogance or something that, like, that doesn't matter that you see them behaving in a certain way because, you know, you also are essentially part of servicing the gallery and promoting what they're doing.
Did you write about that berating, to take that example, when you were doing that piece?
Did I write about the fact that they berated their employees?
Yes.
No, I didn't. You know, that piece actually, I will say that piece that I was working on actually didn't end up getting published. So that whole thing was not going to factor into the piece probably anyway. But, you know, another example would be that I was working on a piece about a trend in the art market, and I went to the opening of a show. One of the gallerists who was participating in this trend had hosted, and at the opening, you know, he came up to me and was sort of yelling and saying, like, you know, why wasn't I part of this piece? Because the piece, when it ran, didn't include him. It included other dealers who were part of this trend. And it turned out, you know, actually I had contacted you, but your press person never got back to me. And so then I saw him sort of yell at her. And, mm-hmm. you know, take the heat off of me. But, you know, you get a sense of how people treat their employees, and mm-hmm. seeing them in action can be very revealing in ways that, you know, just seeing all the public-facing stuff or seeing, you know, so many things in the art world, I think it is kind of self-protective. People don't want to be the one to write something that could be damaging to someone else. I think there is a sort of way in which everybody, I don't know, participates in that. I'm being very clear. I feel like the question was sort of broad, and I'm not sure I'm getting at really what you wanted me to get at.
That's okay. Yeah, no, I mean, I think you, but you raised an interesting point about access, and you mentioned that galleries and gallerists in particular give you access because they want to, you know, it's an opportunity for them to get themselves.
Well, as a journalist, as an academic, actually, it can be very different.
Sure.
I mean, I think that's kind of the interesting thing about wearing both hats. As an academic, like, if you're writing an academic piece on something, there's not the same incentives for, like, say, a dealer to cooperate or to give you their time. And so being on both sides, you see that actually as a journalist, you are part of this, like, promotional machinery. As an academic, you're not seen as that. And so, you know, that's why I think journalists often do have this access and do have this kind of insight that other people in this world or other observers may not have.
Right, but I was even going to challenge the quote-unquote access of the journalist,
right,
which is to say that they are showing you or letting you look into the situation, their environment, to the level and with the angle that they want you to see it only, correct?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, part of the reason why, for instance, like if I were a journalist and I observed a dealer berating one of their employees, I might be incentivized not to cover that because then the next time I need to talk to this journalist, are they going to spend time talking to me?
Right.
You know, it's like journalists in any other field. If you're covering the White House and you kind of expose somebody, you know, for doing some buffoonish thing. I mean, I'm not talking about Trump, but like, you know, some contact who's providing you with information, then, you know, the next time around, they may not be as forthcoming. And so I think on one hand, journalists, I think, often do have this insight, but it doesn't necessarily come into their pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's also maybe, without quite intending it, what I was maybe kind of trying to get at in terms of you being more in academia now than journalism, which is to say that you're,
right,
to what degree you're inoculated, you know, against those kinds of challenges or having to worry about censoring yourself, you know, as you suggested in that situation. If you are on the side writing about something and, you know, let's just say that there's this public berating or berating in front of you anyway, would you still feel like you needed to keep that out because you wouldn't want to alienate them as a potential source down the line?
Well, you know, I mean, I think a lot of my academic work is a little either more historical or,
right,
you know, I'm not sure that it would necessarily be the kind of thing that would be relevant. And I think that's also part of it. Like, if you are interviewing somebody about, say, an artist that they're working with and they go off and, you know, throw a temper tantrum with one of their employees, you know, is that relevant to what you're working on?
When you're writing a piece or a book, for that matter, or you edited this book on the market, to what
right,
extent is inclusion or discussion of the various activities that, you know, are unregulated or are just opaque, you know, the things that are going on in the back rooms, is that kind of thing just inevitably off limits, you know, when you're, you know, because it's not part of the public record and therefore something you academically cannot cover, other than to say, you know, in a million different ways, the market is known for its opacity and, you know, and its
right,
lack of regulation?
Well, it's a real challenge. I mean, I think one thing a lot of people don't realize is, like, even when you see all of these figures about the size of the art market or the amount of money in the art market, a lot of that is based on auction results because gallery sales are not in the public record. Those are, you know, totally private. And so when you see estimates of how big the art market is, it is exactly that. It's an estimate. And this is a real challenge as an academic. You know, you don't want just to speculate wildly. You want things to be based in, you know, fact and archives and something that's documentable. And instead, you know, I think it's something that, you know, as an academic discipline develops, we're going to really have to grapple with is the fact that so much of this maybe isn't accurate. The information that we're getting from, you know, commercial businesses that are in the market themselves and have their own interests in suggesting, for instance, like when you see roundups after an art fair and every gallery is sort of talking about their sales, like how do we know that that's actually a sale that took place, that it sold for that amount?
So do you see maybe moving forward for the time being, and you know, until maybe that part of the market becomes more established or more recorded, you know, as a piece of evidence, that you would gradually be relying more and more on reporting, you know, newspaper and what have you, and book writing, you know, more anthropological and sociological reporting on specific things that have happened, and then those things can sort of be mentioned in the context of talking about XYZ in terms of the market. Does that make sense?
So you're saying, like, relying on reported,
right,
like, journalistic pieces
for the time being, exactly. What you know, as
yeah,
long
well,
as it
I mean,
continues.
I think, honestly,
yeah,
most of the, you know, journalists are closer to what's actually happening than academics are most,
sure,
of the time. And so I think there is a reliance to some extent if you're talking about the contemporary situation from, say, a sociological or anthropological or even art historical type perspective, then you probably are relying to some extent on what's being covered in the press, because they're often the people who are actually, you know, on the ground doing interviews, talking to people, getting some more specific information. But, you know, I think that's also problematic. And as we look forward, I think there will be sort of greater transparency in the art world. I mentioned to you earlier that, you know, I'd been involved in this event at FIT in collaboration with Case Western Reserve and their Financial Integrity Institute about art and money laundering, which just so happened to be a very of-the-moment topic because our event coincided with the proposal of legislation that would put art dealers under the Bank Secrecy Act and regulate the art market under the Bank Secrecy Act, you know, kind of requiring art dealers to implement, you know your customer, as well as recording transactions and other means of oversight. And so, you know, I think that was very interesting, one, in terms of possible ways that either the art market could be regulated by the government or even just more transparency that might come with new technology like blockchain. I think there's a lot of people right now in the art market who recognize that the opacity is something that might have to be addressed. And while obviously there are certain people that are benefiting from the opacity, there's also the potential anyway that that transparency could actually create confidence in the market. And from an academic perspective, I would say that, you know, more transparency could make it much easier to actually know what's happening, as opposed to relying on auction results, which are public. And thus, you know, there are a lot of players who are incentivized to ensure that what is public is going to look positive, right? That's why you hear about, you know, dealers bidding on their artist's work at auction so that, you know, that public sale will create confidence in the private market that you don't see.
Right.
And certainly dealers don't want the work to sell at auction for less than they're trying to sell it at the gallery. And so, you know, I think that ultimately there probably will be greater transparency in the future. But and at that point, the academic research, I think, will look really different.
Yeah, and just to sort of briefly, for just a moment, to go back to your mention of the panel discussion that you gave an intro to, if I remember right, art and money laundering at FIT. The takeaway that, if I recall right, is basically that the vast majority of the participants were against this this bill, and the gist of it, if I remember right, was that they wanted to protect the privacy of their clients. And that reminded me that one of the current and ongoing challenges of that transparency, not only in terms of the specifics around law of exposure, but also in terms of, you know, journalist exposure, is that the dealers rationalize not talking about certain numbers and not talking about certain collectors and, you know, and keeping that opacity, the status quo, is because of the, you know, to protect the privacy of their clients.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that we had a mix of participants in the event. So we had people from law enforcement, from the Southern District of New York, from the FBI, as well as people who are involved in the sort of anti-money laundering industry, and also a lot of people from the art world. And I think that there were different takes on this proposed legislation depending on what background people were coming from. So, you know, I think obviously the people who are involved in this sort of anti-money laundering efforts, and there are firms that specialize in this, are really pro-regulation and see the art market as sort of the last frontier that's unregulated, where there's the possibility of exploitation. And certainly there have been some high-profile cases of late, right, like between Joe Lowe, the Malaysian collector who, you know, has been the subject of now a new book and a number of cases, to, you know, all of the stuff that's come out about, you know, money laundering, financial crime, tax avoidance of late. So I think there is, you know, some awareness that maybe the art market is, you know, somewhat conducive to some sort of nefarious activity. Although people from the art world, as you said, were really, I think, united in their opposition to this, saying that regulation would just put more burden on the small players in the art market who are already suffering. I mean, we've seen a number of small to mid-sized galleries close in the last few years, and you know, would regulation that would impose oversight and basically create sort of onerous workload for them when they're already so short-staffed, is that actually productive or helpful to the art market as a whole? And, you know, the auction houses would say that, you know, they already have legal and compliance departments, so it's unnecessary. And that was one perspective that was presented, which is that the big players are already doing this, and the small players that aren't are just, you know, it's small fry, and for them, it might be the difference between remaining open and having to close.
Mm-hmm. But it was telling to me that the conservative branches or the conservative individuals of Congress were against regulation, essentially, for, you know, typical reasons, that, you know, that they're against regulation in most contexts. But that's kind of it's relatively counterintuitive sentiment, you know, because you picture that most of these conservatives are not supportive of contemporary art, and yet
right.
When it comes, and yet business prevails, you know, and neoliberal capitalism, you know, prevails ultimately. So as long as, you know, the regulation is shot down, it's all good with them.
Well, you know, the bill that was proposed that would include art dealers in the Bank Secrecy Act was actually proposed by a Republican from Indiana, Luke Messer.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't win re-election. He was a casualty of the midterm elections. And mm-hmm. So I guess one of the big questions is whether someone new is going to sponsor this legislation, whether it's just going to fall by the wayside. But, you know, I think that there was some idea that maybe Republicans were interested in this, not because they're generally pro-regulation, but because of the news coverage of terrorist organizations like ISIS fundraising by selling antiquities and things like that. And so maybe that's why some Republicans were suddenly made aware, were suddenly interested in the art market. But, you know, I mean, there's also been talk of legislation from Democrats as well. And so, I don't know. I mean, it remains to be seen. I think for the moment, it's not on the table. But, you know, I think that there is maybe a sense that at some point there will be another bill that's proposed, and, you know, we'll see what happens.
So before we wrap up, maybe we should briefly talk about the Chinese market, since that's something that,
sure.
Since you lived in China and, you know, we're covering the market there. You mentioned to me in writing that you did this studio visit with this Chinese artist. Was that closer to when you were back in China, or was that more recently?
No. No, that was more recently. So, you know, I lived in China from 2006 to 2007, and then I went back. I've been back pretty regularly since then. Mm-hmm. I'd say that was maybe a couple of years ago. And I mean, what I would say in terms of the Chinese market is that, as someone who studies the history of the art market, you know, I think the major story from a historical perspective of the last, you know, 15 or so years really is the rise of China. I mean, we've seen rising prices in the art market generally, and certainly records continuously being broken. But from a historical vantage, I mean, the rise of China is historically unprecedented, I would say. And so, you know, if you think of in the early 2000s, China accounted for less than 1% global market share. So if you look at the art market and you look by different nations around the world, you know, the U.S. has for a long time now been the largest art market in the world. And in the early 2000s, followed by the U.K. and France and other places, I mean, by the early 2000s, where China just represented less than 1% market share, to 2011, when by some measures anyway, China overtook the U.S., to become the largest art market in the world with 30% market share, that's pretty extraordinary. Yeah. And I don't think that that can really be understated as how important that is.
Are there any numbers since 2011?
Oh, yeah. Well, the 2011 was kind of the peak of the Chinese art market. Mm-hmm. In 2012, there was a real retraction. And, you know, and then I think more recently, the Chinese economy has been experiencing a slowdown. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, the Chinese art market is routinely ranked in the top three. So this year, supposedly, and again, this is based on a lot of estimated information because we don't have complete access. The art world is not like an open book. But by most estimates, now China is the third largest art market in the world in 2018 with 19% market share. But before that, for the last several years, I'd say China has routinely been in the number two spot after the U.S.
Mm-hmm. So we've read about this phenomenon of shell housing, shell real estate, right? One of the biggest countries that we've heard about being involved with that is China. So they're buying these properties in, you know, high-end properties in Manhattan and, you know, and in Europe and elsewhere around the world and as investments. And so that preface is to ask the question, is that sort of analogous in the art market? So are Chinese investing in contemporary art for similar reasons, would you say, generally?
Well, I mean, I guess there's a couple of things to say about that. One is that actually the biggest part of the Chinese art market right now is not contemporary art. So even though everywhere else in the world, post-war contemporary is like the biggest category, in China it's different in that still the largest category tends to be traditional Chinese painting and decorative arts like porcelain. So when you see record-breaking prices, it often is not post-war contemporary, although I think a trend is definitely that more and more Chinese collectors, especially younger Chinese collectors who have had more of an international background, often being educated abroad, are really interested in Western post-war contemporary as well as modern art. And, you know, I think something like, you know, when you see Chinese buyers buying a Modigliani or a Picasso, that is a way of participating in a very international market where, you know, in terms of investment, those works tend to be fairly liquid and also have a very international collector base relative to the Chinese categories. But still, the Chinese market is definitely more focused on antiquities than any market in the West. So if we think of old masters as sort of dying category in the West, you know, old masters is still the largest category. If you look at a lot of Chinese auction houses and sales in China. But yeah, I mean, I think that investment is definitely part of the story, and moving money out of China to some extent is part of the story. You know, for Chinese, especially if you look at the rise of the Chinese art market, if you look at 2011, that year that represented the kind of peak of the market, you see that Chinese investors had limited investment opportunities, and so the art market was one place to park their money. You know, over the course of the last 10 years, there have been different types of regulation, but, you know, just to give some examples about moving money out of China or the number of cars that you can buy, these are things that have been regulated by the Chinese government. And so art investment or buying art primarily for investment purposes has been attractive. And that's definitely part of the reason. That's definitely been a contributing factor to why we've seen China just explode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I was also partially asking that question in the context of the anecdote that you shared, which I will.
So to go over what I was saying, right. You know, it's really, really interesting too from a contemporary art perspective because, you know, if you think of galleries in New York, for instance, there's a real effort, I think, to avoid building a young artist up to like a strata that can't be maintained. We saw this, you know, if you think of like the zombie formalism thing in 2013, 2014, all these young artists who got pumped up by the market and then saw their careers sort of crash. You know, that's, I think, what galleries generally want to avoid. And so I think the idea is anyway that you have the steady, kind of a steady trajectory over time where you have incremental increases in price, but you don't like quadruple an artist's price overnight because there's demand. But in China, you know, it's a very, very different market. A lot of artists are resistant to sole representation, to just working with one gallery.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a market that's really dominated by auction houses, so a lot of collectors prefer to buy at auction. It's also a market where I think there's just a lot of interest in investment and buying art for investment purposes. So what I was telling you about is that I had gone to a studio visit in Bushwick with a young Chinese artist who had done a residency program in the U.S. I mean, she's from mainland China, but had done, you know, a residency program in the U.S. and had been in the U.S., located internationally for a little while. And, you know, I was really impressed by her work. And I asked her about, you know, do you have any plans for exhibitions and so on? And she was saying that she had been approached by a gallery in New York, a Lower East Side gallery, about doing a show. And she was basically thinking she wasn't going to do it. And I was thinking, like, well, why wouldn't you do it? It's a great opportunity. You get exposure to the New York art market. Like, you'll maybe not only sell work, but, you know, get on the radar of curators and so on. And she was basically saying that, like, the prices that the Lower East Side Gallery would want to sell her work at were just so much lower, was like a fraction of what she could sell her work for in China. And then she proceeded to say that, like, she had recently sold out all of her available work to an investor in China who just bought everything, like, sight unseen or just, you know, maybe based on JPEGs. And so she didn't have anything really available to sell anyway. And so she was, like, showing us around the studio and was just saying, yeah, all these works have been sold for, like, I forget what it was, but, you know, five-figure sums, like $20,000 or $30,000
mm-hmm.
each.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an artist who didn't really have much of an exhibition history, but, you know, maybe the investor saw that she had been educated in the West or had had these residency programs or maybe just liked the work or maybe just thought, you know, kind of like Charles Saatchi model, like mm-hmm. buy up the whole show and maybe you can sort of promote the work and, you know, sell it at a profit.
And so if you can't mention who this artist is, can you just describe the work briefly?
It's figurative painting.
Okay. that was easy. And what led you, and it's, did you take a class with you to her studio?
No. This is an artist who I actually got connected with through a friend of mine. And a friend of mine had included her work in a show, and I really liked the work, and we went for the studio visit. And, yeah, I mean, I think her work is amazing. I think she's doing really beautiful work and, you know, probably has a illustrious career ahead of her. But to me, it was so fascinating that, you know, it used to be like the gold standard would be to have a show in New York. Artists around the world would come to New York hoping to exhibit, hoping to show their work, and a show in New York would have a kind of cachet that a show even in a major city elsewhere like wouldn't have.
Yeah.
And as someone who lives in New York, it's, you know, too bad that no, you know, we're past that moment where everyone's just flocking to New York thinking that they have to be in this one place to make a career for themselves. But it also seemed very revealing to me that I think there's so much speculation, especially among young artists in China. There's this idea that you can, you know, buy up the work. I mean, not even that cheaply, but you can buy work and maybe make a profit and maybe flip work, or, you know, you're involved in these kinds of speculative activities. And that's become maybe popular enough that artists are making decisions that, you know, they can make so much more money in the short term doing that, that they can't turn that down. Whether or not that's good for their long-term careers, though, I mean, I think that's a big question.
It just seems kind of sad that, you know, she couldn't have some thoughtful conversations with somebody she knew in New York, you know, about, well, what about, what, you know, could I do some version of having this show at this Lower East Side Gallery and sell a lot of work to this guy, you know, like afterwards? you know, or something like that?
Yeah, well, I'm sure the Lower East Side Gallery would be happy to take a cut, right? But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. And it did cause me to think, though, because my initial reaction was like, red flag, you know, like you're selling all your work to this one guy, and it's still in your studio because he doesn't care about taking possession of it immediately because it's just an investment. So when he sells it, he'll want it. But for now, if you're willing to store it for free in your studio, like, why not? To me, that seems sort of concerning. But I also, you know, it also made me confront my own biases in that, like, this idea that, you know, you're better off sort of having this slow burn, you know, career where you sell your work maybe for your first show for like a few thousand dollars, and then you kind of work your way up over time. I don't know. I mean, this idea of the way that your career would be built by a gallery over time might be changing. And I think for a lot of artists, again, like if you can make a good sum of money and, you know, maintain, you know, institutional shows or something else to kind of complement that. I don't know. I mean, I'm curious what you think, like as an artist, if someone said, you know, I'd be interested in buying up all of your work, each piece for some five-figure sum, like whether you would just immediately balk or whether you would be sort of tempted.
Right. Yeah, it's a case-by-case basis, isn't it? You know?
Right. And, you know,
Stefan Semkowitz, you know, you should probably give some pause. But
Right. Yeah. No, and I think I'm generally skeptical of that sort of thing. And you know, I don't know that it's generally so good for artists, because even if you're able to get this big payday and sell your work for tens of thousands of dollars, like, clearly the expectation or the idea is that it's going to appreciate at some point, and you're not going to be benefiting from that. It's going to be the person who bought up all your work who will be, you know, reaping the rewards of that.
Thank you so much to Natasha Dagan for talking to me. Really appreciate her generosity with her time and her thoughts. And I mentioned that about her time because, like I said, we did sit down on the phone for another half hour plus. The reason that we connected again is because a listener, in response to my call for questions for Max Haven of Art After Money, part one and to be continued, a question I got that was directed at him I thought was much more appropriate for Natasha. And so the question was, essentially, there are either artist factories who service the 1%, artists as activists, and art that does not result in a saleable product. There are also studio artists just making their work. Is the model of a studio artist a thing of the past along with the middle-level galleries? So what Natasha and I ended up talking about a lot was certainly the continuation of studio artists, but also the fate and challenge of mid-level galleries, and ultimately the dominance of mega galleries and where that might be going. So that is a bonus episode available to you, and I encourage you to, If you haven't donated a while, or if you've never donated to the podcast, go to theconversationpod.com/support. I will accept, for this particular bonus episode, I will accept as little as a $10 one-time donation. However, I would certainly appreciate it if you could chip in a little bit more. If you donate $35 or more, you will be getting all 7 of the prior bonus episodes, as well as any perks and bonuses that I can offer you. And thank you so much in advance. I really do want to share this bonus episode with as many people as possible. And the way it's very old school, the way this works. So once you are in the queue to get the episode, I basically just send out a MailChimp email to the list, and people reply who are interested, and then I send you a Google Drive, or it might even fit as a regular email attachment of the MP3, and that's it, and then you have it. So yeah, look forward to sharing that with you guys, and I hope that you will donate accordingly to get it. All right, so before we get to Mary Boone and the other old news, I want to take this moment to thank producer, big thanks to producer Andy Davis very much for, as always, for his invaluable vetting of the content that gets whittled down into the episode that you heard. And thank you to Megan Bickle for culling together the old news for the week. The first one, which we'll dive into now, is Guggenheim's Hilma af Klint survey is most popular show in its history. That is from Art News. This also is from Art News. Studio Museum head Thelma Golden, mints ice cream flavor. Get it? Mints. Sugar Hill Creamery in New York is releasing a limited edition flavor that was created by Thelma Golden, the director of the Studio Museum in Harlem. The flavor is called Golden Chai and is made using tea from Harlem's Serengeti Teas and Spices. A portion of the proceeds from the ice cream sales will go toward another neighborhood venture, Hot Bread Kitchen, quote, an amazing nonprofit social enterprise that creates economic opportunity through careers in food, unquote, Golden said in a statement. Studio Museum members get 10% off. Again, that's from Art News. And finally, the cleanup hitter of the week from, and I think this is the first time that I've read from them, I'm almost positive, Town and Country. Is that still a print magazine? I think it might be. It's definitely an online institution. And the piece is called Mary Boone is Taking a Break. I've had a wonderful time, Boone says. I didn't go down in any of the 3 recessions. I didn't suffer from Madoff. I have my health and my wonderful son. So I'm going to go away for a little rest for a couple of years, unquote. This last line comes with the hint of a sob. Boone's crime, for which the Internal Revenue Service pursued her for more than 7 years, is falsifying tax returns from 2009 through 2011. The IRS found that in 2011, she remodeled her apartment for approximately $800,000 and called it a gallery. She ran up beauty salon expenses of $24,380, as well as $14,000 on products from Hermès and more than $5,000 from Louis Vuitton, and noted them all as business expenses. She said her gallery lost $52,521 that year, when in fact it made $3.7 million. She paid $335 in federal taxes when she should have paid $1.2 million. In May, she will be going to the federal prison in Danbury, Connecticut, for 30 months. Past inmates include Leona Helmsley and Lauren Hill. Boone doesn't want to talk about how she came to do what she did, though she says that it was incremental and nuanced. I think that's how it happens, she says, unless you're blatantly cheating, unquote. She says she always deducted her home, for example, quote, it's no different than an artist deducting a studio he has in the Hamptons or New York City off his federal income taxes, unquote. Somehow she found herself crossing a line. Not long before the sentence was handed down, Boone says, she called Martha Stewart for advice. The maven of entertaining famously drew prison time in 2004 for trading on inside information. If I could handle my situation with the grace, intelligence, humor, and humility that she did, I would be happy, Boone says. In Stewart's office, the two talked of how to cope with the stigma of prison and how to make a new life. People have been amazing to me, Boone says, yet sometimes bitterness takes her off script. Quote, Al Taubman got a year and a day for a $100 million crime, she says of the one-time Sotheby's chairman. Stewart got herself 5 months. In the tight-knit world of New York art dealers, not all have empathy to spare. It didn't help that Boone's lawyers asked for special consideration during sentencing, arguing that Boone had suffered a childhood, quote, marked by tragedy and poverty, unquote, which led to mental health issues, drug and alcohol addiction, and a deep-seated fear of destitution. A woman of such emotional fragility, the lawyers claimed, might not survive in prison. Gently, the judge dismissed their pleas. How can I sentence someone to jail for narcotics, he intoned from the bench, and not for tax evasion? There's a lot of schadenfreude out there for a dealer who played hard and wasn't as collegial as some others. She's a very strange person, says one art world heavyweight. Intense, even obsessed, very self-involved. If Mary calls, it's only because she wants something. It's not catching up with a pal. A rival dealer adds, she has a minuscule frame of reference. She didn't care about the news of the day, just her role and her artists. But that, of course, can be said of many people in the art world. Wow, I really need to, that's the piece. I really need to find out who wrote this piece for Town and Country. Will you bear with me for just a second? I'm going to look this up. Mary Boone is taking a break. I am copying and pasting into my browser. Should I use DuckDuckGo for this? I'm going to try DuckDuckGo and see if that works. It did. Came up first in DuckDuckGo. Mary Boone is taking a break. She's about to spend 2.5 years in prison, and Boone, the gallerist who helped ignite the art world's decade-long boom, is wondering how her life went bust. Oh, and there is a picture of her. You must look at this picture. It's her, apparently, in her library, or maybe the gallery's library, and she has an expression that is a mix of coy, melancholy, and sadness about her fate, perhaps. Now, who is the writer of this piece? Because there's no byline at the top. So I'm just going to scroll down to the bottom of this piece, which has a lot of pictures, by the way, if you want to check out the article on the website, townandcountrymag.com. Let's see. Keep going. Advertisement. Come on, you article author. Okay. Ross Blechner. Nothing come out. I guess this is loading really slowly. This is a long piece. Wow. There's no byline. Who wrote this article? This story appears in the May 2019 issue of Town and Country. Okay, subscribe now. But that doesn't tell me who wrote the piece. All righty. Well, I guess we're not going to get some closure here. Maybe the person who wrote the piece didn't want to have to get into, you know, be involved in legal skirmishes potentially for this article. Interesting question. All right. Well, I'm just going to wrap up by saying, check out this article. There's a lot more than what came from this clip in Old News. And why did I read from this? For one, as I said, I think that I did, you know, mention a brief line that I think was from Caroline Miranda about Mary Boone and tax fraud, and I thought this might give us some closure, the fact that she has indeed been sentenced and she's going to prison for 30 months. Of course, this is not a quote-unquote dangerous prison. This is a white-collar prison. But the schadenfreude thing, I think we reach out and hold on to downtrodden, disgraced figures because when it comes to the art world, a lot of us, particularly artists, have a lot of fear and frustration around those in power in the art world. And here is the downfall of a current slash formerly powerful figure in the art world, a decades-long successful dealer. Now, if you have counter opinions that you would like to share about this, and maybe you've shown with Mary Boone, I would love to hear from you and hear your side of it. So do get in touch. And finally, before we go, Max Haven Part 2 coming up soon. So and that one's definitely going to provoke you into questions for the following Max Haven conversation. So anyway, you have that to look forward to. Thank you very much for listening. I hope this wasn't too awkward an ending. Thank you very much for being here and your support. I will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Until then, ciao for now.